paid into Medicare for decades. Don't spend retirement limping. The Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. It's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000.
Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
And we're coming up on 12 minutes after 12 on this Thursday afternoon, a beautiful Thursday afternoon, at least Dennis Rodkin is to be believed. Dennis writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business, and he is in the studio this afternoon. Dennis, welcome.
Hi, Steve.
So you've been out walking around. Everything's really nice.
Yeah, I'm sorry that you're not allowed outdoors, but yes, it's beautiful today.
I'll get outdoors eventually. So Dennis is here. He comes by every other Thursday. We talk about what's new in real estate. That's coming up. We'll be visited from CNET and then Elise Glink in the second half hour as well. She's brought this up before, but all about video, the importance of video when it comes to marketing your business. Video is certainly important when it comes to marketing your home, too.
Oh, heck yeah.
All right. And selling your home. So we've talked about this story before. This woman who I think she was in Glenview, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was suing Zillow. Now, I love Zillow. I love to go and, you know.
It's addictive.
When I'm not looking at my 401k, yeah. I'll go and see what my home value has changed because they'll actually calculate it from, I think, almost day to day or month to month. And it's really doesn't mean that much, but it's nice to see. So she's selling a house, and the Zillow estimate is well below what she's asking, what she thinks it's worth. So she's suing Zillow because they're not licensed to give estimates for homes, something like that, right?
Well, that's sort of how it started. She's also an attorney, and so a year ago, May, that was what she was doing. But eventually, that case was replaced by one where she was simply representing homeowners who were in that situation. So she was no longer a complainant, just the lawyer. That suit claiming that appraisals act, I'm sorry, Zestimates act like appraisals, that part of the suit was dismissed last fall. So what they pursued was this idea that it's consumer fraud, it's a deceptive business practice, because according to the suit, Zillow's Zestimate is essentially a bait and switch. It brings you, they don't tell you that they're advertising, they don't, and there are various other ways that they were trying to claim it's deceptive business.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, it's sort of according to them, it sort of looks like an appraisal. You don't know it's an appraisal. It's not an appraisal. And on Monday, the judge in the case threw that out as well. So this case has now been dismissed permanently. The first time, parts of it were dismissed. The second time, the whole thing was
dismissed. So she killed it dead.
She killed it dead, yeah. And essentially what she said is, I mean, this is not the legalese she used, but anybody can find on Zillow's site that it is not an appraisal. Anybody can find on Zillow's site the page that says, from Zillow, here's how inaccurate our estimates actually are. And in Chicago, Zillow's data says that they come within 5% of the actual price only about half the time.
Wow.
So Zillow's pretty clear. We said this in the earlier stories, but Zillow's pretty clear about saying, this is just sort of for fun. But this lawsuit was based on if those numbers are out there on the listing for my house, and I'm asking more than the Zestimate, then you're turning off people who might pay more,
and
who
I
might
think,
pay
you
my
know,
price.
Sometimes I have a little too much fun and I'm cruel with people.
No.
First. And so I might have with this woman, but I can't empathize with it. I mean, I do understand if you're trying to sell a house and all the potential buyers are coming in seeing the Zestimate that's for $100,000 less than what you think it's worth. That's a tough thing.
Zestimates and really the whole online real estate marketplace has made a change in how we sell houses, because while real estate agents have always worked with comps and that sort of thing, 20 years ago, it was very difficult for a buyer to find out what you paid for your house 10 years ago, what other houses. It was very difficult to come up with a value. So if you said it was worth $100, they sort of had to work with that as a starting estimate. Now you can do so much research online, and one chunk of the research has been done for you in the Zestimate, that if you say it's worth $100, it doesn't take me very long online to find out that, in fact, it's probably worth more like $85. And I'm going to start from there, not from your 100.
So the idea of finding two or three other homes that were sold on the block or within the neighborhood in the past 5 years for comps is much less relevant now than it used to be.
That's part of what goes into the Zestimate,
right.
And that's part of the online research. But 20 years ago, your real estate agent could do that, but it wasn't always available. It was hard to find, that sort of thing. And it's just buyers and real estate agents have so much more information in their hands that this idea that if I say my house is worth $100,000, that's the starting point, has kind of gone away because there's so much online that says, yeah, that guy's a little ambitious. It's actually worth about 80, 85.
All right, let's go to the lakefront. Winnetka.
Yeah.
Someone is spending $6.2 million for a house to tear it down.
To tear it down, yeah. You and I have talked about a couple of these. There was an $8 million tear down in Glencoe, or $8.5 million. Tom Ricketts, who owns the Cubs, tore down a $7 million house in Wilmette. This one in Winnetka is one of two megabucks teardowns in Winnetka so far this year. Somebody bought a $10 million house in January, which we talked about. They may be tearing it down. They had a demolition permit, but haven't yet torn it down. And their real estate agent told me that there may be a change of plans. But these people in the $6.2 million sale have a demolition permit, have a construction plan. The documents I could get said that their total cost, 6.2 for the land and 3 for construction, would make it about a $9.2
wow.
million house minimum.
So they're going to spend twice as much for the vacant house than they are to build the new house.
Well, one thing to keep in mind is those construction estimates that people put on permits really are for the basic construction of a shell and plumbing, anything covered by code. But how much do they spend
the
on
glitter?
Marble?
They don't have the glitter in
there.
They
don't have the glitter, yeah, and the marble and the wood and the this and the that. None of that goes in. So $3 million is a minimum, really, on construction. But yeah, you know, I mean, people are spending. What's going on now is we're seeing these $6, $10, $7 million parcels go because, as you know, they're not making any more lakefront land. I mean, there is a limited number of North Shore lakefront parcels, and the price just keeps going up.
That's Dennis Rodkin. He writes for Crane Chicago Business. You can read the stories at chicagobusiness.com. We're going to take a break, come back, and talk about a couple of project announcements coming up, right, in the next couple
Big
of
ones.
Days. So,
yeah.
Okay, so these are stories that you are about to write.
Yeah, in the next couple of days, I and my colleagues.
A couple of big developments. And we've talked about this one area on the south side, near south side, that in the history of Chicago has never been developed.
It's
always been sort of vacant or wild land.
And it's so close. It's from Roosevelt to Ping Tom Park. It's basically from Roosevelt to 16th Street on the east bank of the south branch of the river. If anybody's gone to Ping Tom Park outside Chinatown, it's immediately north of that. The park stops sort of abruptly at this wild land.
And we're going to find out this week what they're going to do there?
We're going to find out tonight what they're going to do there. It's a company called Related Midwest, and they have made a few announcements in the past. Part of Governor Rauner's Innovation Institute is supposed to go in there, and they've said we're going to extend the river walk and a few other things like that. But tonight we get the details of what they're going to do on this half-mile long site beyond simply saying mixed use.
And then the other one is where the Spire was going to be built, to the east of us here, north and east of
us. Yeah, this is, I mean, it's a big week for this company, Related Midwest, because that's a very, very visible spot. Everybody's, even people who were not aware of it until the Spire came along, you watched the saga of this enormous swirling building that is going to get built and then doesn't, and then there's a hole there for nearly a decade after. What will go on that site will be announced on Monday. Same company.
Any ideas?
I assume it will be tall. I mean, given that it's a small site, that it's very visible, I can't imagine that they wouldn't put a high rise there. I'm guessing that they go for a high-end architect just across the street. They are building a building that is around 80 stories. It's by Robert A.M. Stern, who's a very high-level New York architect. They've worked with big-name architects. I would imagine that given such a visible site and almost sort of like a psychological scar, it wasn't their site
before.
But when it was to be developed before, it was going to be this Calatrava building. So I would imagine that all that that sort of says we got to put something really
fabulous.
Got to go fabulous.
Big. Yeah. All right. So we've talked about Trump Tower before and about how the condo sales there may have been suffering from the Trump name, that there wasn't a lot of sales and things like that. When we talked about it, you also said that the number to compare was pretty small. I mean, there hadn't been a lot of sales anyway.
But after that, there were two big ones. Two big
sales
maybe in the $9 and $10 million range.
So then in Cranes, there's a story this week about how, and I didn't realize this, since the building's been built, they've had thousands and thousands of square feet of vacant retail space that they can't get anyone to move into.
Which is kind of hard to believe. When you walk under that arcade that runs along the river next to Trump Tower, it's those levels below. If you were to come across the river on the water taxi, you see these arcade, these rows of windows and things. When the tower was built or was being built, the idea was that this would be shopping space. It would be very desirable. And to me, you would think it would be very desirable because it's such a spectacular building, and those lower levels look right out on the water, open onto that plaza where you go to the water.
There's a lot
taxi.
Of life across the river from it too.
Yeah,
and so it'd be visible.
Yeah, and it is part of. It's an early part of that effort to enliven our riverfront, and yet that space has sat empty. A couple years ago, when it had been empty for a while, Donald Trump, then not the president, told one of my colleagues at Cranes, I'm not concerned. It'll get rented. We're going to try another way. We're going to turn it into ballroom space because they hadn't gotten the retail they wanted. Now there's a new brochure out that my colleague Albie Galoon reported on. No comment from the marketing people, but they're marketing the space without the name Trump, Albie pointed out. They're marketing it by the address of the building on Wabash. And he believes, or he reports pretty conclusively, that that could be a way to say, you know, let's market this for the space it is. I mean, you and I have discussed, I think no matter what you think of Trump, it's a beautiful building.
Yeah.
And if his name were not on that building or people didn't know his name, their opinions of the building wouldn't be as warped as they might.
It looks like it was a problem filling this space long before.
Long before his name went up on it. That's true.
Right.
And one of the reasons that is that, so I mentioned these nice windows along the river, and that's wonderful, but then it goes in really deep. So it's these deep, dark spaces and no windows on the other side, because on the other side, you know, it's essentially tunnels. And it's an underground space. So one of the problems is, how do you chop that up? And that was why they said ballrooms, ballrooms generally have artificial illumination. And this would be the same idea for a restaurant. I don't have to sit by the window.
Dennis Rodkin, thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.
Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
And here we are in the Allstate Showcase Studio along Michigan Avenue on this beautiful Thursday afternoon. Hey, I want to take a couple of seconds to talk. I've mentioned a couple of times that we're working on a new WGN Steve Bertrand travel trip, and we got it all together now. It's going to be a trip to Ireland and departs on September 30th. Now, if you listen closely over the past few years, you know that every once in a while I get access to these Van Morrison concert tickets. He does just a few shows a year in Belfast. It's in a hotel ballroom. Only 350 seats. You sit like you have dinner there, like you're at a wedding, and then out comes Van Morrison. So I never know if I'm going to get him. We got him. The problem is now it's a short turnaround to fill the trip to make it a go. So we need to talk about it before the end of June. September 30th departure, you'll go to Dublin, Donegal, Derry, which is a great town in Northern Ireland, one of the most fascinating cities I've visited in Europe. Some cool stuff, too. The Guinness Storehouse, there's a literary walking tour in Dublin and all of that. It's all for about $3,800. Oh, and also Dave Hoekstra from Nocturnal Journal here on WGN from the Sun-Times, written books about travel, big music guy. He's going to lead it for us. So I know Dave's going to talk about it in the future, too. We'll have a link up probably by the end of the day. But if you want me to email you information, just send me an email, steve@stevebertrandtravel.com, or give me a call, 847-606-6065. The tickets will run out. You know, obviously, they don't have a lot of seats in these shows, only 350, so we're limited in the number of people we can bring. But I hope you will check it out and consider joining Dave Hoekstra on a trip to Ireland coming up in September. All right, on a phone line now, we're going to talk. Oh, I'm fascinated by this story about Google Assistant. And Ben Fox Rubin is here. He's a senior reporter for CNET. Ben, welcome back to the Biz Lunch. Nice to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to start, Ben, can we play that audio? So Google has unveiled their new assistant. It's like Alexa or Siri. They're trying to make gains in the market. And one of the ways they're doing is by using an incredibly realistic voice. So we're going to play audio from them. And out there in Radioland, I want you to tell me which of these two is the robot. Uh-huh.
So Friday, November 3rd, how many people?
Four, two people.
Two people?
Yeah.
What time?
At 5 p.m.
Okay. And your name?
The first name is Daniel. That's D-A-N-I-E-L.
All right. Ben is on the phone line. Ben, you tell me, what is it we just listened to, and why is it potentially a game changer?
Yeah, so that's Google Duplex. It's an experimental new technology from Google that they announced this week. It's basically a human-sounding Google Assistant that can make phone calls on your behalf, but only specifically for certain things. It's for scheduling restaurant reservations or hair appointments. So it's not like it's this very broad artificial intelligence that's going to work as your personal assistant for anything and everything.
So in the audio we just listened to, the robot was Daniel. The robot was, so say I've got, I'm using Google and I ask my assistant to make a reservation. He then calls the restaurant and says, I need a table for two. My name is Daniel.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something that is already raising a lot of moral questions.
Because if I'm taking reservations, I want to know if I'm talking to a real person.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it does kind of make you feel like maybe you're being tricked. So Google already said that, first of all, they're going to move very slowly in rolling out this technology. They're not going to make it widely available quite yet. And on top of that, they are going to provide some sort of disclosure, some sort of disclaimer to whoever's on the phone with the robot to let them know that it is, in fact, a robot. The problem there is that why does the robot sound human then? Why does it have all those verbal tics,
Right. Does
and mm-hmm, and elongate sentences if the point isn't to trick people into thinking they're talking to a person?
And, you know, I was talking about this off the air, and a friend of mine said, well, we already get those robocalls, but this is very different from that, because the robocall will wait for you to make a sound, and then it will play its next recorded piece of audio. In this case, the robot is actually interacting with what it's hearing on the phone.
Yeah, that's another issue, too, is that what if robocalls, you know, the spam caller companies end up developing a similar type of technology or gain access to Google's technology? Is it possible that, it would be more easy to scam you or keep you on the phone for longer? There are just a lot of thorny questions that get raised over Google creating something that sounds that similar to a human voice on a phone call.
Well, I think it was key what you said, that Google said that they're mindful of this, so they're going to roll it out slowly. That doesn't mean they're going to take it back. It means it's inevitable. They're just not going to come out as quickly as you might think they would.
I am not a robot, by the way.
Right.
I'd like to be clear about that.
And tell me one more thing before we move on, that this passes, and I didn't know what this, it makes sense to me, I guess, the Turing test.
Yes. Yeah, the Turing test is a test that's been around. It's a concept that's been around for decades, that essentially a robot could fool a human into thinking that it is a human. So this could technically pass the Turing test, but only for hair appointments. So we're not quite there yet.
And that's named
after, an interesting idea.
And named after Alan Turing, who was the computer scientist from the before World War II, the British scientist, right?
Exactly.
So let's move on then to Amazon. I go to the Best Buy and I see all these things I can buy and use in my home with Amazon. Kind of hard to figure, though, or to place it. And so Amazon is what? They're buying homes? They're putting things in homes? What's going on?
No, there are 15 Lennar-owned model homes that are all over the U.S. that Amazon this week announced that they're basically turning into showrooms for all their technology. So you can go to these things called the Amazon Experience Centers. There's no tour time or anything. You just show up when they're open, and they're filled with all sorts of gadgets for smart homes. So the Echo smart speakers, Amazon-owned Ring video doorbells. You can also see different Amazon services, like Amazon Home Services, where you can hire a plumber or an electrician. So it's basically a big showroom for Amazon stuff because it doesn't really have a lot of its own stores.
I want to ask you one more thing. Glassdoor is a company, well, actually a company that we talk to here on the Business Lunch from time to time, just purchased by a Japanese human resources company. What does that mean for its future?
It probably means its future is very bright. The thing that I found rather eye-popping about this acquisition, which, by the way, hasn't quite yet closed, is that the deal is worth about $1.2 billion. So I guess the recruiting world is very there's one where there's a lot of money involved. I didn't realize Glassdoor was worth that much money.
Ben Fox Rubin, a senior reporter at CNET, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing the news, providing input, and breaking down the stories that matter to the world of business. Does Chicago need another sports team? Sure, why not? Cubs owner Tom Ricketts announced his purchase of a new professional soccer team, part of the United Soccer League. It's an opportunity that comes with plenty of development for a new soccer stadium built from Sterling Bay along the Chicago River near the Lincoln Yards. If there are two things that Chicagoans have gotten pretty good at over the years, it's sports and seeing good business opportunities. And the new Mom Project has nailed their business opportunity down, and they're getting their own after an announced $2.6 million round of funding. Just in time for the upcoming Mother's Day weekend, the Mom Project is a marketplace that connects employers with new-age moms that are looking to get back into the workforce. The two-year-old company has already gained a huge audience, boasting 500 employers, and it's bound to grow as demand for women in the workplace continues to be pushed forward. Behind every great company, there's an army of moms. Tune in tomorrow for all of your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
Back to Steve Bertrand and the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are at 12:52, coming up on 1 o'clock and the John Williams Show just around the corner. Okay, Elise Glink is on the phone line. Elise, of course, is the brains behind ThinkLink.com, the CEO of Best Money Moves as well. That's the HR app that we talk about from time to time. Elise, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Nice to be here.
Okay, so honestly, you picked this topic today, so I don't want to make this sound completely self-serving. But, you know, I have this travel business. We got a group going. I've got a group in Ireland right now. I've got a group that I'm leading going to Norway. Dave Ennett's taking another group to Norway. We were talking with them last night. And I know that one of the ways that I need to improve and to grow my business is to use video better when it comes to marketing what I do. Now, my daughter knows that too, so she has sort of tricked me into buying for her a new video camera. She's going with us to Norway, where she promises to produce some gang up videos. All of that having led up to you, and you said that you wanted to talk today about the fact that video is bigger than ever when it comes to B2B marketing.
It is, and I'm really glad to hear that you're in having your daughter go with you. I'm sure you'll enjoy having her around anyway, but really, people in their 20s and 30s have such a different vision of video and how helpful it is in the B2B marketing space because that's how they prefer to get their information. And what struck this to me about this topic today is I've been working with a new client, and the client is in, the owners of the business are in their 50s and, you know, even a little bit older. And their vision of how video should be used for marketing is a bit different than the reality. And so we've been trying to work with them to get them to understand how 20s and 30s, who are the target end user of their website and these videos, would be consuming them and why they need to produce them and produce them even a little bit more aggressively than they were thinking.
All right, not to betray your client, but what is it that they got wrong? What is it someone my age might get wrong when it comes to producing a video that would appeal to younger people? Because I have an idea.
If you talk to somebody, yeah, well, you talk to somebody in their 20s and 30s, and they would rather see it in a video than hear, than read it. And to them, they can, and Google makes this really interesting. If you go to YouTube, for example, you can watch videos at a double time speed. And
really?
I look at my, yes, and people are consuming these videos at double time speed and just consuming the information faster than people our age have been trained to do. And so what we've, you know, are working with these clients on is, you know, when you're showing property and they're in the real estate space, or when you're trying to reach people in their 20s, using video to convey that message, whatever the business is going to be your most successful outcome.
Yeah, my idea was
deliver that.
What I was going to say, and this sort of that speaks to the same thing, is it's got to be short. I mean, it's like writing a newspaper article or an essay. You know, you might have a lot of beautiful words there, but you got to toss them because you don't have the attention span for everyone to pay attention to every wonderful image that you've got. You've got to be, it's the whole less is more thing, even when it comes to video.
It is. And you want it to just be beautiful images, but you want the messages to be fast, because remember, they can stop the video if they haven't finished reading it. So the ability to send a message through that's speedy and relevant and gets them to where they want to go in a minute, maybe minute and a half, that's the goal that every company should have, using video to attract that younger audience. And truly, the audience for, you know, who's a 20-something for your product, that video will be even different than an audience member who's maybe in their 40s. And so you want to keep it all in mind as you start to map out the messaging.
And I would imagine the same video, but different versions for different platforms, right? So if you're going to post a video on Facebook, you probably want one that's going to draw someone in 20 to 30 seconds, draw them to the longer video rather than post the long one right away.
Right. I see a lot of videos that are irrelevant on LinkedIn, for example, but LinkedIn is a great place to do B2B marketing. So if you're trying to attract people to your business that are decision makers in companies, identify who that decision maker is, understand what they're looking for in the information, and then provide a very quick video for LinkedIn that answers that question. If you're looking for a consumer and it's a B2C and you're going to go to YouTube, or you're going to stream through YouTube onto your own channels or social media, that's going to be a very different video and a different video message. And so keeping that audience in mind and the differentiation you need, that's top of mind for marketers.
When you're creating a video, do you put everything in the video, or do you put a tease in the video to bring people somewhere else?
Oh, geez, you're talking like TV. But I think that you want to give more complete information. People want to make their decision. They don't want to have to go someplace else to get another piece of the information and then another piece. You're not going to string them along. That way they're going to lose interest and fall off. So my clients, we recommend all the message up front. It's clean, quick, simple. Get them to a call to action. You want them to get to that call to action and make a decision of if they're going to pursue it, because that means when they finally hit your landing page, they're so much further down in your funnel, further along in making that decision. And that's where we want to get, where you want to get your clients to as quickly as possible.
Elise Glink, thinklink.com. Thanks for talking today. I appreciate it.
Sounds good, Steve.